I would trade him if I could.
I don't think many people liked it, to be honest. I don't care.
Last year didn't really do well for anybody.
We should probably delete all of this.
By the laws of the podcast gods, we owe an answer.
Reporting the Highline with Rabbi in Red. Talking the rapids and turning heads. With questions from you and analysis. In your car or in your home. Thank you for tuning to Holding the Highline.
Hello, Colorado Rapids fans. This is Holding the High Line with Rabbi in Red. We are brought to you by Icarus FC and Roughneck Scarves. My name is Matt Pollard. It is Wednesday, March 31st, 2021. The United States men's national team has failed to qualify for the Olympics for the third time in a row, and that is not an April Fool's joke. The Colorado Rapids remain unbeaten in preseason and will wear mint green on the road this season. And tomorrow is opening day in Major League Baseball, so happy opening day, Rockies fans. It's going to be all downhill from here. I'm joined now by a man who yearns for the taste of leavened bread, Rabbi Mark Goodman.
It's good to see you, Matt. We are on spring break with the kids, and that means that Dad has to come up with interesting activities for year two in quarantine. Yesterday we went to a hike to Gristmill, and the kids whined the whole time and said, can't we go home yet? And today we went to a comic book and Magic the Gathering shop and spent an hour, blowing money on irresponsible purchases of a childlike nature. And that was awesome. And that was easily as much for me as it was for the kids. I just wanted to throw out to our listeners before anything else gets said that Matt is resplendent. Yes, resplendent. In the Timbers Away kit from, 2015? Something like that?
Yeah, I think it was 15-16, Mark.
Whoa, I feel good about myself right now. It's the red and black one, which I remember when it dropped, I was like, you're the Timbers, you wear green, you can't wear red and black. And then, like, I'm looking at this kit right now, and I'm like, man, that is a hot kit, I love that one. Why are you wearing that one today, Matt?
Red's my color, and also I got it. It's the, so I've been cycling through between this podcast and Last Word SC, which is generally about MLS and American soccer that I do over at Last Word with Daniel Sperry and our mutual colleague, Rachel Krieger, Mark. I was going through and kind of thinking, which one of my kits have I not worn on one of the two podcasts? And this is the only kit that I can't distinctly remember somebody wearing during one of the podcasts to the point where somebody could comment on it, because obviously somebody would have commented on it. I wear an FC Dallas kit and people have questions, and I have that kit because I did that jersey swap with the friend Steven who I went to his wedding in 2019. I've talked about him on the podcast, but I don't remember anybody saying, like, Matt, why are you wearing a red Timbers kit? And I'm like, well, if I'm going to get a Timbers kit that isn't Michael Azira signing for the Portland Timbers, Mark, I might as well get the one that's red, because as you know, red's my color, which maybe is just a further call to the Colorado Rapids. Anybody who has control over what color their secondary kit is, you come out with a red secondary kit as opposed to burgundy, I will drop an entire paycheck's worth of money on that red kit. Red's my color, people. And I will, and as long as it's not RSL red or Brentford red or for some reason the Canadian men's national team is playing the United States and is wearing a red kit, I feel no shame in buying a kit that is red that I, in a vacuum, think is cool, Mark. But we've discussed my jersey fashion sense, and some people disagree with it, and that's fine. I look cool, and I don't care what you think.
I'm also wearing red, but that's because it's suddenly turned cold again here in Pittsburgh. It went from 75 yesterday to 50 today and rainy, and tomorrow's supposed to be 34 degrees, which I don't understand, but hey man, that's spring. What are you gonna do? Let's talk some soccer, buddy.
Let us do that, Mark. So we will start. Mark, have you been on Twitter today, and have you seen what Jozy Altidore had to say?
Well, I'm on vacation, so clearly I have a lot of free time, which means I'm probably on Twitter way too much, and holy bajolies, Matthew, what the heck happened on the Twitter today?
Okay, listeners, so you can go over and Jozy Altidore, U.S. men's national team and Toronto FC striker and designated player, tweeted from his account, verified, at Jozy Altidore. Taylor Twellman, oh, he didn't even possessive it, so, but in any case, I am not someone who should be the arbiter of punctuation and spelling issues on Twitter. In any case, Taylor Twellman's national team career was laughable. Beasley should be that analyst or a Mia Hamm. Twelman needs to be on Extra Time Radio with Bobby Warshaw. He, a white boy with connections, stop giving him a platform. Josie tweeted the end quote, or end tweet. Josie tweeted this while quote tweeting a tweet sent out by One Soccer Mark, in which it looks like a few mostly English-based analysts kind of talking and reacting to the United States failing to qualify for the Olympics for the third time and what endemic or institutional issues may be that indicates, and particularly in response to a video that Taylor Twellman put out on his personal Twitter account, at Taylor Twellman, capital T on both of the T's, basically saying that the failure to qualify was pathetic and laughable, and that any of the comments about how, oh, we didn't have our best U23 team, you know, we had 15 players who would have been eligible for this team play in the friendlies against Northern Ireland and against Jamaica, all of them would have been, you know, better than the players that we had there, and then even then there were the three Atlanta players who were unavailable to play as well. This is a function of the COVID times and us not being able to get our best players in because of COVID and quarantine and travel, and because this is not a FIFA sanctioned tournament, and therefore teams do not have to release their players for this qualification, and then him referring to that as excuses. The One Soccer people can go on to say those aren't excuses, they're facts and they're reality of it, and it affected the United States in ways that it didn't affect Honduras with a Honduras heavy team or most of the young and exciting talent outside of like a Chucky Lozano. And there's one other guy whose name I don't remember, Mark, who people have been quoting and saying, well, he wasn't here. Those two players play in Europe. The overwhelming majority of the rest of the best available U23 players for Mexico play in Liga MX. They were able to work with the federation, the teams, to release them. And clearly MLS had struggle enough in even getting some MLS teams to release their players. And so is that an excuse? Is that a valid complaint? And kind of that analysis. And so, Josie Altidore decides to, kind of come after the hot takes of Taylor Twellman, and in, Tweldog saying that the U.S. not qualifying for the Olympics again is laughable, then said, well, Twellman, your career is laughable. There were people who, and the comment section is a place that I scrolled through and read stuff, listeners, in order to be prepared for this piece. I would not recommend you doing it. There's a lot of negativity there and racism going on, but effectively, here, Mark, there are some people kind of wondering, quote, Taylor Twellman's national team career was laughable, end quote. Was that referring to, Mark, his failure to qualify to be on the 2006 men's national team for the World Cup? Was that in respect to the fact that he didn't do a whole lot in the 2007 Gold Cup, then under Bob Bradley? Or was that potentially a comment as, well, Twellman's national team career wasn't really that good because it was cut short, and in that, Josie is criticizing or making fun of, literally in the word laughable, the fact that Twellman's career was cut short by massive concussion injuries? And then kind of the other comment of, he a white boy with connections, of kind of the, I don't know if reverse racism is the right word, Mark, but I'm sure if we're talking right now about Michael Bradley, another equivalent player in Josie Altidore, but one who's white, tweeting saying that Marisa Dew's takes are laughable, his national team career was laughable, and the only reason that he is a color commentator with Fox Sports on soccer is because he's a black boy with connections, you know, that we would be, like, people would be calling to cancel Michael Bradley, Toronto FC would have to put out a statement, Chris Armas would be asked about that in his next media availability. And kind of the last thing on here, Mark, is kind of where Josie's directing some of the shrapnel of this tweet bomb that he posted, and whether or not Extra Time deserves to be on that, given How do I put this, Mark? I would say that there is an argument to be made that at least on the surface, MLSsoccer.com has historically been a place for white men in the media space, as we've seen with some of the layoffs and the other ways that they've handled and prioritized some of their writers, some of their editors, and then some of their media personalities, that it is a bit of a old boys club. I have spoken with a former female contributor to MLSsoccer.com, Mark, who shall remain nameless, saying that that's how she felt. She hasn't been at the site for 3 or 4 years now. But so that kind of being a thing, when we look at that with a bunch of white guys, generally, you know, who had no national team careers because Andrew Wiebe and David Goss and Matt Doyle never played professional soccer, and kind of the, is that who they should be directing it at? And then also kind of whether or not Bobby Warshaw deserves to be in there as someone who I would argue, Mark, you know, he was still playing in Scandinavia when you and I were reading articles that he wrote for Deadspin, probably for freelancer money, possibly for free. And so did he really have connections, or did he have to work his way up and then the book kind of got him on the map and then he wanted to get into the media? He was with Extra Time and then now is no longer with Extra Time. Not really sure what happened there, Mark. It was kind of a cryptic way that he left the site, and, you know, the guys who were still on the show said they were going to talk about it, and then they never really did and dropped it. But in any case, I think that there is a healthy argument and discussion to have here, Mark, in that DeMarcus Beasley, well-respected national team player, every single time I hear him get interviewed or talk about soccer, he talks about it at a high level intelligently. I need more DeMarcus Beasley hot takes in my face on my timeline. I could say similar things of Mia Hamm. And did those people not get opportunities because of, in one case, the color of his skin, in another case, because of Mia Hamm's gender? Or were those environments that were not hospitable for them because of the lack of ethnic and racial and gender diversity that would have happened in the media space? I'm not entirely sure, Mark, that Beasley or Hamm would have been interested in doing media stuff. That being said, when I think about big, you know, women color commentators that we have on the national level, not specifically working for a team, you know, it's Julie Foudy with ESPN. And then I would argue, Heather O'Reilly with some of the stuff that she's done, albeit a little bit independent. And I would say, Mark, that, you know, our mutual friend and colleague, Jordan Angeli, has been excellent as well, albeit doing a bunch of individual stuff, not quite a big ESPN or Fox Sports personality in the way that Taylor Twellman is. So I think there's a healthy argument to be had here. I think Josie brings up a valid point. I think some of the other things that he had, Mark, you and I don't get offended a lot. I'm not sure we would ever ask for an apology if someone was trying to offend us. I don't know that we would ever ask for an apology on behalf of someone else, but I want clarification from Josie Altidore about what he means specifically when he says Taylor Twellman's national team career was laughable. And what about it was laughable? Was it the lack of goals? Was it the not contributing too much in the Gold Cup? Was it failing to make ultimately the only, national team World Cup that he would have been contributed in as he was still kind of a youth player in 2002 and failed to be on the 2006 World Cup? Or is Josie being ableist and poking fun at Twellman's career being derailed, both at the national team and European opportunities, because of concussions? And then also, I don't know enough about Twellman's situation getting into media as to whether or not, I know his dad played in the NASL. He had a few other family connections in there. He played most of his professional career in Boston. That's pretty close to New York. Did he know somebody who knew somebody at ESPN who could get him in the door? I don't know enough about the situation to know whether or not it was nepotism and networking that got Taylor Twellman into the door of opportunities at ESPN. But again, that kind of begs the question of wanting him, and ultimately stop giving him a platform is Josie effectively saying that he doesn't care for his hot takes. And regardless of what you say, Mark, about Taylor Twellman, I feel that his heart's in the right place in terms of talking about the game. And even though he's opinionated and a lot of people don't like his opinions, he gets people thinking and talking about the game. And I think most of his opinions are genuine. And say what you will about not liking Taylor Twellman or Alexi Lalas as players, the way they handle themselves as commentators, or some of their opinions, I will die on the hill of both of them contribute to the sport in that positive way, in that they get people talking about the game with their opinions and stimulate meaningful and engaging debate.
Woo! Matt, with many words, he had takes. Matt had takes. First of all, I think I'd probably almost, lockstep agree with almost everything you said. I'll just say one or two things in a slightly different way, Matt. The first thing, I'll take the second part of the question first, referring back to the old movie Quiz Show, which if you haven't seen, is a really good movie. I haven't seen it in a really long time. Highly recommended. That was a movie where they would and it was based on a real show, where they would hand over like a 15-part question and the guy would say like, oh, I'll take the third part first. And da-da-da. Anyways, the second part first is, how legitimate it was for Josie Altidore to attack and criticize the entire soccer media landscape in the way he did. And I'll say it this way, I think Josie Altidore took a carpet bombing like approach to the situation with American soccer commentary, which meant that, yeah, he hit the target, but he caused a whole lot of collateral damage. And the other way I'll say it is there was a tactful way to say that there is racism in soccer journalism and in media punditry. And there's a less artful, less tactful way. And knowing Jose Altidore's kind of history of hot takery, we can generally assume that he's going to go with the latter, right? He's going to spray friendly fire all over the place and hurt people where he probably didn't need to. You know, I'm a man of the cloth, as it were. And so if I can find an artful way to be critical, but still press the issue, I generally will. What I mean by all this is I think Josie probably is right for calling out American soccer media for being mostly male and mostly white, because that's the truth and it sucks and it's not fair. I think you borderline overstep your boundary when you specifically call out individuals and say, you're the wrong guy and this guy is the right guy, right? Like, because, you know, Charlie Davies and Susanna Collins were both on Extra Time. They're both really good at it. Susanna Collins got spun off to her own show. She is still an important media figure at MLS and probably always will be. She'll continue to get opportunities. And Charlie Davies, I'm not exactly sure what Charlie Davies' role is at MLS. My guess is that he's kind of an adjunct player because he's doing commentary for ACC. He does some commentary for USL, so the guy's got, he's getting work. But that being said, should Charlie Davies be a full-time contributor to Extra Time? Should he be in the regular rotation? Absolutely. I think he's a phenomenal commentator. He's a brilliant mind in soccer, and I really appreciate what he has to say. But he may just need to, like, pick his spots and so on. But for Josie to kind of come in hot on specific media personalities and say, that guy doesn't deserve a job, this guy does, it's to your point about, like, you know, Josie doesn't even know whether Mia Hamm wants that job. How realistic is it that Mia Hamm, who's married to Nomar Garcia Parra and owns LAFC, actually wants to do a podcast on Major League Soccer every week? Like, I wouldn't want to do that if I were Mia Hamm. I got better things to do, you know. She's going to be really integral to Angel City, which is kicking off in a year and a half. So that's really, you know, that's where it's at, you know. But so that's a little bit about, like, where Josie went wrong on this. But I'll kind of defend Josie a little bit in the sense that, like, when you're the victim of systemic racism in soccer and specifically in soccer media, if you got to punch a little bit below the belt in order to make your point, I'm here for it. I'll accept it. Like, I kind of understand it. The second piece that you kind of, the first piece, which I'll take second, is the question about Taylor Twellman. My guess, and this is a guess, and because I don't really understand where that came from, because I really do think that Taylor Twellman had an exceptional MLS career. He didn't have an exceptional.
He scored more goals in MLS than Josie Altidore has, albeit Josie went to Europe. So I think the, you know, I, you know, again, I'm further confused by the comments, Josie made towards Taylor's playing career, and then furthermore, does having a quality playing career indicate that you will be a good pundit? Because, Mark, I'm not entirely sure that Michael Jordan would be the next best addition to the TNT crew that they have with Shaq and Charles Barkley, etc.
Right, and I'll agree with that point in a big way. I think generally most athletes believe that being an excellent athlete means that you have more credibility when you speak about your sport, and I don't think that's true at all, right? I think, you know, my favorite little vignette about that is from Ken Burns Baseball, where he talks about a conversation that Mickey Mantle had with Ted Williams about hitting. And Williams was asking, you know, when he looks at the ball, does he do this? Does he do that? Does he raise his elbow? You know, when he sees a curveball, like, does he think about dropping his stance a little bit? And like, Williams was really a student of the game, was really, like, thoughtful and critical. And Mantle's response was basically like, I don't know, dude, I just swing and hit the ball. Like, some athletes are really pure athletes in the sense that, like, their brains aren't hyper aware of everything they're doing. That's why they're great athletes, but they're not great pundits, and they may not even be great coaches because they're not able to kind of, explain why a guy can or cannot hit a baseball or can or cannot, you know, succeed at soccer. Like, I generally am skeptical of excellent athletes when they become coaches because, you know, to your point, like, how's Michael Jordan going to tell a kid, like, how to play defense or how to set up for a situation? Like, Michael's just going to be like, why can't you do a better job? Just do better, you know, like, but anyways, back to the original point that I was making about, Twellman and Josie being a little bit off base on it. I think it's possible that Josie was being critical of Taylor Twellman's national team duty because the national team wasn't particularly good in the era that Twellman played in. You know, like the 2000 to 2010 U.S. men's national team was kind of aimless, you know, like until 2006. So, the 2010 team was a little better. The 2014 team was clearly the best in a long time. But like, I think that's where you could come at, that's my guess. And my guess is, and my response to that, of course, would be, that's dumb. Like, you know, you don't expect one player to represent the entire national team and put the whole team on his back and be their everything. So I don't know. I mean, the last thing I'll say is I feel like he undid a lot of what he said and proved himself to be kind of like just angry and foaming at the mouth and not necessarily making a whole lot of sense when he criticized Bobby Warshaw, who hasn't been on the show in a year and a half, you know, to your point. Like, I think criticizing extra time is fine, but when you're not actually aware of who works at extra time, you kind of undo your point. So I want to finish though where I started, which is to say, Josie has a valid point in criticizing how white and male soccer media is, said one white dude to another white dude on a podcast.
Okay, yeah, so I agree with what you said there, Mark. I guess the things that I'll add, and I don't know that I'm ever going to be in a position to ask Josie about this. I guess he might be in the preview or post-match availability through Toronto FC, who will be playing the Colorado Rapids one time later this season, and so, but I assume he's going to be on extra time before that. I'm sure Grant Wall would love to break down everything on his podcast with him. There will be other people who will get Josie's attention and be willing to have this discussion with him before I, a person who he's never spoken to, minus, I think, one of the national team games that was here in Colorado a couple years ago. You know, there will be other people. So the thing that I would hope those people, like Grant Wall, who had a pretty measured take. I will include links to all of these tweets here, folks, in the show notes so you can check them out. You know, I would want to clarify what he meant by Taylor Twellman's national team career being laughable. Clarify by the specific calling out Extra Time Radio and Bobby Warshaw. Elaborate on what he means by white boys with connections. And then also, since he refers to stop giving him a platform, on some level, Mark, I have to think that Josie's implying here that he disagrees with Taylor Twellman's take that he has on the Olympic national team. So as a former youth USMNT national team player, as someone who has watched these U23 teams, and in the case of just this past week, U24 team, fail to qualify for the Olympics, what ideas or thoughts does Josie Altidore have as a current senior national team player, as a player who was a part of the failure to qualify for the 2018 World Cup? What systematic issues does he see? What remedies does he have? And I think that could actually have an organic discussion, and maybe in that he disagrees with some of the hot takes that Taylor Twellman had, and we could actually have a productive discussion on that. And kind of the last thing that I want to say, circling back to my initial point and the point that you ended on, Mark, of, you know, what more, as someone who is an older player where a lot of the teammates and people who you looked up to are now retired. Like, is that something that they're talking about? I spoke with Worldy Harris, Mark, and I'm not sure we're going to feature that interview on this week's show, but certainly before the season starts, about opportunities for coaching and that for former black players in MLS getting opportunities in American soccer. Is this something that some of his past black or female teammates I guess he wouldn't have had female teammates, but, you know, other USMNT female players have commented on feeling like there aren't opportunities of. It's not something that I've particularly given, you know, maybe, again, this is an indication that I'm part of the problem in that I haven't thought about it, but what are some of the people who he's speaking to who are looking for work in media or starting to get in media? What are they saying? What are some of the issues that are going through? Let's have a discussion. Help me better understand the situation, because clearly it's something that I'm ignorant too, regardless of whether or not DeMarcus Beasley or Mia Hamm are interested in it. Let's get to the actual soccer failure and cluster bomb that took place this past Sunday, Mark. The U.S. men's national team failed to qualify for the Olympics, 2-1 loss to Honduras. We won't go through the specific game, Mark. You know, it's been a couple of days now, and there have been other people with bigger platforms who've gone through and kind of discussed what happened and why. But I guess your thoughts on the failure itself, what it says about that team and the actual tournament, Mark, and then how much of that can we gleam as this is an indication of institution-level problems in American soccer that need to be resolved in the same way we had this discussion post-Trinidad and Tobago 3 years ago?
I mean, it's disappointing, but it's not disappointing in an unsurprising way. The Olympic team hasn't been particularly great for a while. You know, one of the observations that everybody has been making is this was the C or the D team because they don't have, like, to your point about Jozy Altidore's comments, they didn't have their European players, so that kind of hurt them in their ability to qualify. But those are excuses, and those excuses aren't necessarily important or legitimate because we just want to qualify, we want to show progress. You know, there were specific things that bothered me about that game. I feel like it looked desperate and sloppy a lot. You know, there was possession with desperation for basically all of the second half. There was a lot of, you know, rushing to get the ball up and moving the ball into this in the same pattern, into the same spots over and over again. You know, there was this fear of coming centrally or an inability to overload the middle, and this, you know, kind of desire to go wide and then try and pick something out from wide positions or take a guy on the dribble from a wide position and then send in a short cross. I saw that a lot, and I was like, why? Like, that's not a play I actually see senior national teams use a lot. It's not a team, not an attacking method that I see a lot of success at the professional levels either. So I had serious questions for Jason Kreis specifically that I didn't really understand why they were set up the way they were, what they were trying to accomplish, what the idea was here. There's another piece here which I think is relevant and notable, but I think one of the things that we think about when we think about the under-23 team is the trajectory of development of U.S. soccer as it stands. And I think, you know, what we already knew is that the United States is not in the top 16 or 24 nations of the world, and we're not moving in the direction of being in the top 24 or 16 teams in the world with any serious haste. Development is a really long, slow process. I feel like the most, being that I've been a youth soccer coach, a youth soccer administrator, a person who comments on National Academy soccer and follows it, a guy who watches college soccer a lot, right? Like, I watch soccer players in the United States under the age of 21 more than almost anybody who isn't a professional paid A licensed coach in this country. And I understand how our system works and how the faults in the American financial model of our development system, and why we're not cranking out talent at the rate that Iceland and England and Germany are cranking out talent. And to that, what I'll say is I think there's, you know, when you read the comments section of anything, you'll see that most USMNT fans think that we can go from 0 to 60 really, really fast, that all it takes is poaching a few dual nationals from Germany or Mexico, getting the right coach, and, you know, getting Christian Pulisic enough minutes at Chelsea, and we'll win the World Cup. And it doesn't work that way. Like, it does, it's not at all how it's going to work. I've always thought that America is probably 30 years away right now from winning the World Cup. And the idea that we were going to qualify for the Olympics and then storm on in there and have a top finish when we're not there yet developmentally is laughable, and is why I wasn't particularly committed to whether we won a spot in the Olympics or not. I wasn't optimistic that we were going to be successful if we went to the Olympics. And the fact that we didn't qualify in the end is disappointing, but doesn't surprise me. Matt, you know, what did you see from those players? Who of the, amongst those players, like, maybe let you down? What are your thoughts on, you know, what this means for development and the connection between the youth team and the national team? And finally, what are your thoughts on my take on Jason Kreis?
I'll pull a U mark and I'll go backwards to front because that's how I took my notes down on your thoughts. And I've had some time to ruminate on this. I'm officially convinced, Mark, Jason Kreis is a system coach. He's not a particularly good man manager. He's not a particularly good evaluator of talent. And then let me get in that talent in a way that is ultimately going to gel. I increasingly give more and more credit to the successes of the Jason Kreis era at Real Salt Lake to Garth Lagerwey, who was the general manager for the duration of Kreis's tenure there. When he was head coach, Garth Lagerwey now with the Seattle Sounders and has been a big part of their recent success with him as general manager. He's a system coach, Mark, and that system is 4-4-2 diamond, possession-based, really solid ball-pinging number six. I thought he had that in Jackson Ewell. I think Jackson Ewell has a really good shout to be in competition with Kellen Acosta to back up that Weston McKennie, Tyler Adams role in a critical national team game later on this year. And certainly if we get to a World Cup, I think those two will be competing for one spot effectively. But he didn't have a go-to number nine. They were playing in a 4-3-3, trying to press, trying to play out of the back, which isn't really the way RS Snell played with their possession-based system going back to, what, 2008 to 2013, I think, with Jason Kreis. And so he's a system coach, and I think this is an indication, I think, similar to the failure to qualify for the World Cup of buddies getting hired by their buddies within U.S. soccer and not doing their due diligence and it being more, well, Jason Kreis is available, so let's ultimately hire him. But so now, like in retrospect, I'd want to ask Jason Kreis, you know, hey, Jason, coach, you got hired to coach the U-23s. For the duration of your tenure there, you tried to mimic what Greg Berhalter was doing with the senior national team. What was your understanding getting interviewed, going into taking the job of that? What were your ideas in terms of were those going to be the exact same? How much flexibility did you have? Did you take the job with the understanding that you had to play Greg Berhalter's system, which is not your system, with players who weren't going to be able to fit that at the Olympics, as opposed to let's just qualify and if it looks ugly or if I just play like my 2009 RSL team, then that's totally fine. I want clarification from him, from Ernie Stewart, and possibly from Greg Berhalter on that. To your point, Mark, I echo your issues about player selection. You know, Jesus Ferreira, David's son, scored in the opening 15 minutes against Costa Rica. After that, Mark, how many frontline forwards scored for the U.S. in this tournament? How many other goals were scored by number nines or wingers in this tournament? Zero. All the other goals that you had came from midfield. God bless that Jackson Ewell was on this team and was actually able to get them through. They didn't play great, and I didn't see a lot of great finishing. And now I think the training sessions that they had before selecting the final roster weren't open to the public. Maybe secretly Eric Williamson, Cole Bassett, Jeremy Abobasi, all three players who've been proven in MLS, who have been proven starters on playoff teams in MLS in ways Jesus Ferreira was not. I would argue Hassani Dotson has been mostly a bench player for Minnesota United. Certainly Sebastian Salcedo and Soto were not impressive in this tournament at all, Mark. They didn't show up in that same way. So, I mean, how bad was Jeremy Abobasi to the point where you thought Jesus Ferreira would have been a better false nine in the system than Jeremy Abobasi was? So I have issues about the player selection independent of the players who weren't available, whether it was the three Atlanta guys who weren't available. Obviously, I think Miles Robinson would have been better than Henry Kessler in this tournament, Mark. And I kind of have to wonder the second point that I have is about the lack of camps and the de-investment in money, time, resources, and camps that you had at the U23 and the U20 level in the last 2 years. Doug McIntyre, I believe, Mark, had a really, really great tweet. I'll find it and I'll include it in the show notes, folks. Basically breaking down the difference in how U.S. soccer and how the Mexican Federation treated this age group over the course of the past 2 years. In the last 2 years, Mark, the Mexico U-23s played 20 games. The United States U-23s played 2. And so I kind of have to wonder, not in a nepotistic way, Mark, did Jason Christ say, I'm starting Justin Glad at center back, RSL player. I'm starting Aaron Herrera, mostly at right back, RSL player. And I'm starting David Ochoa, RSL homegrown goalkeeper, because those three have played together with each other, and I haven't had camps, so it doesn't matter what I would have tried to do. Henry Kessler and Justin Glad have never stepped on the field together, except for maybe one game where RSL played New England 2.5 years ago. And so I question that and how this group didn't have some continuity, because watching them play out of the back was painful to watch, Mark, and I'm shocked that there wasn't a plan B and that they never really went to plan B. I think the one area where I'll disagree with Taylor Twellman, where I might be on Josie's side here, Mark, in the rant that Twellman had, he said, the only teams that have medaled more than twice in the history of the Olympics have been Brazil and Germany, and those two teams are, historic powers that you have when it comes to the World Cup. I think the Olympics would have helped U.S. soccer. There's a really good episode recently of Orange Slices, Mark. Mark McKenzie and Keith Pierce did a podcast, and they interviewed Marisa Du, and he talked about that Olympic team and the playing and qualifying and then getting there and playing well in that tournament and that providing the opportunity for him to go to Europe. I think the Olympics would have provided an opportunity for a breakout U.S. star who would have gotten an upgraded opportunity at the club level, and that could have helped them with the national team. So I think the Olympics would have helped for a handful of individuals. I don't think very many of the guys who are on the U-23s will be sniffing anywhere close to, like, David Ochoa and Henry Kessler and Hassani Dotson are nowhere near going to Qatar in a year and a half. So I think the Olympics would have helped individual players at that age group, but it's not an indication of senior team success. Like France and Italy have missed the Olympics because there's only 16 teams they're allowed to qualify. Honduras, who beat the U.S. to qualify, they've qualified the most under the current iteration of the tournament 4 times in CONCACAF. Mexico's only been 3 times. And yes, okay, Honduras has done a good job at this level, Mark. Mark, Honduras regularly is not considered a favorite to even qualify for the World Cup. Furthermore, they have never won a game at the World Cup. So don't come at me with the success at the U-23 level or at the Olympic level is an indication of being really, really good at the World Cup. It's not. And the last thing I'll finish on, Mark, which is maybe the most significant thing that we have from a Rapid standpoint, we saw the nightmare of issues with Jonathan Lewis being unable to finish, not being a 90-minute player, and fading in and out of games that have been detrimental to his time with the Colorado Rapids, and I believe are a valid concern about him at the senior national team level. And when Fox Soccer or Paramount Plus or ESPN Plus or a future streaming site that doesn't exist yet, Mark, wins the rights to broadcast this tournament in 3 years' time, and they open up with, can the U.S. for the first time in 4 cycles qualify for the Olympics, they're going to play a highlight reel of the failures of this team to qualify for this tournament. It will include the Sean Johnson howler in Nashville from qualifying for the 2012 Olympics. And I believe it will include one, if not probably both, of the chances that Jonathan Lewis had. The header that he heads directly at the Honduras defender, and then him wrong-footing that chance that he had from, 4 or 5 yards out. And I think Jonathan Lewis fairly deserves to be part of the criticism, especially given the lack of scoring prowess that you had, and him actually being one of the better players that you had at the club level. Mark, let's move on to something fun and something green. And that, of course, is the Colorado Rapids finally released their new secondary kit that they'll be wearing for 2021. It is entitled the Class 5 Kit, referring to the most difficult class of hiking and climbing trails that you have. It's officially mint green, Mark, though it has similar template to the white with the secondary off color that we've seen in Major League Soccer secondary kits from Adidas in the last couple of years. So it is a mint green. We are getting, folks, the classic dark green Rapids color for the shorts. So I'm really excited to see whether or not the shorts come available, Mark. And then kind of the cool little zoom in detail that you have a particular thing that I'm a stickler for when it comes to fashion detail of zooming in, Mark, is the almost topographical map shapes that you have. And the topo maps that you have are of 6 of the 14ers that you have in Colorado, Grays and Torreys, which are right next to each other, Pikes Peak, which is down in the Springs, that I'm sure Sam Vines will be very happy about, Mark. Mount Bierstadt, which is, I know from Colorado Public Radio, Mark, is not only, it's one of the easier 14ers that you can do, folks. It is also per the, I can't remember the Trail Society organization that tracks it, but it is the most hiked 14er in any given year in Colorado. About one out of every, one in every five persons summiting a 14er takes place on Mount Bierstadt, then Mount Evans, which is the one that you can drive to, Mark, and then Mount Quandary, out there in Summit County as well. Very fascinating peaks, Mark. I'm a little upset that Elbert isn't on here, given it is the highest peak that you have in the state of Colorado, and certainly Long's Peak, Mark, as the highest point in Rocky Mountain National Park. But certainly I, as a hiker, am very excited about this. It's cool that we get to see a reprise of one of the previous colors for the Colorado Rapids, Mark. It's cool that there is a specific detail that is can be appreciated by Colorado fans, and it's really cool that it is that it's something that's different. I think we've talked about this every time we talk about new shirts coming out, Mark. It's really nice if you can be one of the, wow, they nailed it, that's an awesome shirt, but really you just don't want to be the one that everybody's poking fun of, or the one that you can't tell it's your shirt if they take the crest off it. And so the Rapids are in none of those categories. Is it as awesome as the Jimi Hendrix Sounders kit? No. Is it as awesome as the throwback MLS 1.0 kit that we got from the LA Galaxy, or the cool, like, Chargers, baby blue and yellow that we got from the Philadelphia Union kit? No, Mark, but it's one that I think Rapids fans will really like, and really that's the, it's one that Rapids fans will like that is actually done with the understanding that this is for the Colorado Rapids, and I think in that, that's the only thing that really matters to me. Mark, your thoughts on the kit and your thoughts on RSL's attempt to clap back at the kit.
I love the kit. I've seen a little bit of criticism from MLS schools that, you know, there's a couple shots of the kit, I think up from the MLS store that make it look pretty white, but it's really, and I think, you know, we have yet to see how it looks on in a game. And I think, you know, one of those things that happens with kit drops that's really common is we all get confused about how it's going to look in real life. You know, I think a lot of people show a hypothetical kit template with lots of really cool features and stuff, and they make it like extra tight on a super, you know, attractive muscular mannequin. And they don't realize that that actually won't look that way when it comes to playing on the field, because human beings don't look like, you know, mannequins. They have to flex and move and bend and twist. And the other thing is, you know, a really great kit can be a really great kit, but is it going to work with the socks and the shorts? How's it going to look in different kinds of light? So those are all really important things. I think for me, I'm a broke ass middle-aged man from a middle income bracket, and that also means that the only challenge to this kit, Matt, is I'm 99% sure that the replica version of it won't have any of the cool features that the official authentic version will have, and that means that, like, unless you want to shell out the full $104 or $88 or whatever it's going to cost this year to buy the kit,
it's $150. I think it's more than $150 if you want to get it customized too, Mark. So
that's a lot. No, you know, then like it's the replica version is just not going to be nearly as good. I think that's one of the downsides of having a topo map, you know, on your kit. I only own. Well, now I own two because I was gifted one by a player, but I've only bought one authentic kit, I think. I think in my whole life of 44 years, I only have three sports jerseys that are the authentic as opposed to the replica, because they're so darn expensive and I feel so weird about justifying the cost. So that's my only objection. But that being said, like, I think it's fairly likely that at some point, maybe not this year, maybe I'll wait till it comes, you know, comes 2 years from now and is the off brand. You know, they've replaced it with something newer and sexier, but, you know, I am almost certainly going to buy this kit at some point because it's a great one. It's really good. I kind of interrupted my own train of thought because I have ADD listeners, but, you know, I think it looks a little white on the, MLS store website. I do feel like it's likely to turn out to look pretty minty. And, I'm optimistic that from reports I've heard from people who actually have the kit in their hands, that it's just going to be a lovely shade of green that really nobody else has ever done. And to your point, Matt, about RSL clapping back, I thought that was so weak and so pathetic. And I was like, you know, sometimes RSL social media person does a good job and sometimes they don't. Honestly, all MLS social media people are hit and miss. That was a straight miss for me. Of course, it's easy for me to criticize the RSL social media guy or gal. I don't know who it is.
Like I said, Mark, I like it. I like the color. I like the design and everything. I love that it calls back to a specific thing that is very, you know, unique to Colorado. So in that regard, you know, this hits it out of the park relative to the Black Diamond kit that I feel like was a, here's what you have and let's try to put some marketing and sentimentality and symbolism behind it. This kit was designed with the understanding of it is for the Colorado Rapids and it is by Colorado and it is Colorado for life. Just the last thing that I'll add, Mark. So this would have been the home kit now of last year, folks, that RSL was referring to in their tweet where they said that, you know, imitation is the greatest form of flattery that mediocrity can commit here. Technically, Mark, their kit was representing or similar to topography, but not an actual topo map that you have. I'm an engineer, folks. I do site planning and everything. I look at topo maps. Topo maps are supposed to, basically a topo map is a map that shows the elevation levels. And so you have contour lines that you're actually looking, and those lines represent an area where the elevation is the same at ground level. So effectively, Mark, if I was doing a topo map of a cone, it would effectively just look like a bunch of perfect circles, one inside the other, inside another smaller, until you get to a point, you know, just a dot representing the top of the cone. Similar, but obviously misshapen in the case of a mountain face, if you're just talking an independent mountain with its own presence and everything, folks. If you go back and look at the RSL kit, it is actually more of wavy lines like constant W's overlapping, like cursive W's overlapping with each other. And furthermore, Mark, the lines actually have variable thickness in the wavies as well. Topo maps are not supposed to have, it is supposed to be the same thickness across the entire line, and it's supposed to be, unless you're showing the elevation based on the thickness of the line, are also supposed to be the same. So, I would argue, RSL did an imitation or what was supposed to look like a topography map, but wasn't actually a topo map. And the Rapids, I guess by imitating it, did an actual topo map and did it better. Furthermore, Mark, I would point out how many 14ers exist within the state of Utah?
None?
There are none. There are no 14ers. And there's one 13er, Mark. So, you know, and there's like five that are at a 12 level, for example. So, I mean, I could get to the highest point. I had to train for 3 months 2 years ago, folks, to get to the top of Mount Elbert, and it's the hardest thing that I have done physically. Give me a month to hit the stair climber in my gym, which is currently closed right now, and I could be at the highest point of Utah in 6 weeks. I could not say the same thing about Colorado. Joining the 13ers club in Utah requires one hike. Joining the 12ers club requires like five or six hikes. You could live in Colorado and hike regularly, folks, for 5 years and still not do all of the 50-some 14ers that exist. And furthermore, Mark, if we want to say what is actually original, Switzerland, their national team for the 2016 Euros, actually did a topo map of the Swiss Alps in their primary red kit with the white shorts as well. So in any case, I guess RSL can claim being the original in terms of MLS topographic map like. They are not the original in the history of all of soccer kits, and furthermore, they didn't do it as well as the Colorado Rapids. So I guess imitation is the best form that greatness can do to imitate mediocrity. And furthermore, Mark, what was the scoreline of the only game in which RSL wore their topo-like map jerseys against the Colorado Rapids?
Was that the one where you wrecked them 6-0?
5-0 and won the Rocky Mountain Cup. So I guess that's the greatness. Beautiful. That RSL was talking about. Speaking of actual greatness, folks, the Colorado Rapids earlier today, Wednesday, March 31st, played in two 45-minute friendlies. The first was against FC Tucson, in which the Rapids played a mostly first-team lineup and then a mostly bench lineup that you had in their second 45-minute friendly against LA Galaxy 2 Los Dos. They won the game against FC Tucson by a score of 2-1 after giving up the first goal. Clint Irwin was in goal for that game, and then the two goals from the Colorado Rapids came first from Andre Shinyashiki assisting to Keegan Rosenberry, so a nice goal for K-Rose there, Mark. And then Jack Price setting up Andre Shinyashiki for the winner as well. And then the Colorado Rapids wrecked LA Galaxy, but LA Galaxy 2 by a score of 3-0. Mark, Los Dos has been bad in USL recently, yes?
Pretty bad. I mean, I don't remember the last time they were even relevant in the Western Conference.
Okay, so point taken on that, folks. And Mark, it was a hat trick for Nicholas Mosqueda, and it was, I don't know what happens when you get three assists. But Colin Warner did that. So if you want to know what the score sheet was for all those folks' goals, every single goal was from Mosqueda, and every single assist was from Colin Warner. Mark, the Colorado Rapids continue to be unbeaten and have won every single game that they've played in preseason. They've now have an aggregate score line of 11-1, which is that one goal coming from FC Tucson. They're playing well. Kind of the biggest takeaway for me, Mark, is something that actually didn't happen on the field. Diego Rubio and Brian Galvan have yet to play in any of the preseason games that we have. They are still listed as out from injury. Heard from a club official today, Mark, that again, nothing serious. They're just dealing with it. There's no indication that they do not believe at this time that they will be unavailable for the start of the season. Not sure how concerned we are with Brian Galvan, Mark, given how well Michael Barrios has integrated in the team and the options that they have at the wide role. It's good to see Andre Shinyashiki now have three goals in the preseason, but obviously we know how much this team and the coaching staff rates Diego Rubio, and not having him right now is something that could be, you know, inhibiting the team's start to the season, given how the things that he does well that Robin Fraser really values in a striker. But, you know, Mark, if we're going to have somebody come out, having Andre Shinyashiki is not something that I would be freaking out relative to, oh God, what do we do if Jack Price isn't available to start the season? Mark, your thoughts on anything preseason related, these two friendly results today, or the injuries to Brian Galvan and Diego Rubio?
Not a lot of thoughts. I'm sure they're minor injuries. I hope they're minor injuries, and this is just the kind of thing that happens at the beginning of the season. I think growing up a baseball fan more so than a soccer fan gives you a real window into what preseason means, which is not a lot. You know, you can't watch a dude hit 500 in spring training and assume that he's going to come out of the gate and, you know, be the next Mickey Mantle, as I referenced Mickey Mantle twice in one podcast. What are the odds? I'm not even a Yankee fan, you guys. And so, you know, like hearing Nicholas Mosqueda just light it up today doesn't necessarily do much for me. I mean, I really like Nicholas Mosqueda and have been super frustrated by the fact that the dude can look spectacular in 5 and 10 minute bursts, but seems to disappear for long stretches of a game. And it feels like Mosqueda should have 5 years ago pushed his way into a regular starting lineup, and rather has just established himself as your lockdown 75th minute substitution in midfield. I don't imagine that today's result changes that at all. I think Mosqueda is a break glass in case of emergency midfielder as a starter, but I think it's pretty much chiseled in stone who's going to start in the midfield three for the Rapids. The Rubio injury is a little more worrisome considering there is zero depth on the Rapids at center forward. It's really hard to tell whether there's anybody who can take over that position other than Shinyashiki. And also perhaps
Nicolas Benaze would have been the only other one I'd come up with, Mark. But at that point, I think you got to change formations, because
the other one is Darren Yappe, who we'll talk about when we get to the final segment. But that's a big stretch. Matt made a sudden light bulb look, and then he also had this mild furrowing of the brow as I said it, which is like, I'm correct, and I'm reading. Matt and I know each other way too well at this point. We're like an old married couple. I could see the light bulb in Matt's head, and the light bulb in Matt's head was, ah, yes, I forgot that Darren Yappe is a forward. And also, the furrowing of the brow was, there's no freaking way the Rapids are going to put a 17-year-old as a starting striker in Major League Soccer. And the response to that is, Yeah, but if Diego Rubio can't go the first week and maybe Nicolas Benese has a quad strain or something like that, and you need Shinichiki to play on the left side, and, you know, Berrios is showing well in training, and you're missing Cole Bassett because he's off with some sort of national team duty, or, you know, he's not available for some reason, you got to move Yunus Namely inside, then you don't have a whole lot of options. You have to play Darren Yappe inside as your center forward. And the other thing is, you know, really great players force your hand. I don't think anybody thought that Cole Bassett, when they signed him, was going to push his way into the senior team in 2018, but he did at the end of the season. Maybe because they wanted to give him a go, but then he actually scored a goal. He looked pretty good. They started to play him in 2019. Then he really pushed his way into the team in 2020. Like, you know, I don't think I anticipated Cole Bassett's career arc into, you know, regular starting midfielder for the Colorado Rapids in a 4-3-3. And he did. So you can say, like, it's unlikely, but anyways, point being, I don't think we can do a whole lot with spring training. I'm looking forward to them actually broadcasting a game, which I will hopefully be able to watch this weekend. So that'll be pretty exciting.
Yes, I guess that's the one thing we didn't mention, Mark. You will be able to stream. I believe the stream's geolocked, ?
Yes, but there are ways around this map.
Yes, there are ways around this. But in any case, folks, the Visit Tucson Cup will begin this coming Saturday when the Colorado Rapids play in a preseason Rocky Mountain Cup against the aforementioned imposter topo map, RSL on Saturday, and you will be able to stream it. So no issues with the, oh, do we have DirecTV or anything? And like you said, Mark, there are ways around if you are not within 90 miles of the Colorado Rapids home stadium, Dick's Sporting Goods Park. I'm not saying you can, I'm not saying you should, folks, but you are physically capable of pausing this podcast right now, going to www.google.com and looking up the words, looking up VPN and learning things and reading stuff about that may or may not be useful or educational in your pursuit of living 91 or more miles away from Dick's Sporting Goods Park and wanting to be able to stream the Rocky Mountain Cup preseason Visit Tucson Cup game for the Colorado Rapids this coming Saturday. Mark, two things that I forgot to mention about the jersey. The little side tag that they have in the lower left upon wearing the jersey, again, has the C96, C referring to the letter C in the Colorado flag for Colorado, and then also 96 with them being an MLS original. And then the new shoulder sweat neck tag that they have on the back says One Club, and the One Club text on the neck tag reflects the ethos of the Rapids, the crucial connection and authentic commitment to togetherness that drives the culture of the club. We are pulling in the same direction in the constant pursuit of our vision. So I know, Mark, there were a couple fans commenting on, well, the Rapids focus on rivers, and they called it the Class 5 jersey, which is technically a mountain climbing one, but the marketing team there came up with a way to subtly sneak in a we're on a raft together and rowing in the same direction pun there, and I'm here for it. Or at least I'm connecting those dots, so I'm speaking it into existence, and I'm here for my own speaking that metaphor into existence. Last thing that we have on the show for this week, folks, we got a news dump on some more loans from the Colorado Rapids. We spoke last week about Jeremy Kelly and Andre Rawls, who are on their way to Phoenix, not too far down from Tucson. But we know that there will be 5 members of the Colorado Rapids first team, Mark, who will be sometime this week, I presume, heading out to Colorado Springs to join the Colorado Springs Switchbacks FC on loan. And that will be goalkeeper Abraham Rodriguez, defender Sebastian Anderson and Michael Edwards, midfielder and GA rookie Philip Mayaka, and forward Matt Hunley. All 5 of those players will be going there. And then under the terms of the loan, the Colorado Rapids can call them back at any time for the remainder of the MLS season. Just same conditions that they had for the Phoenix Rising loans that you have as well. So, Mark, I guess I don't know where you want to start in terms of who, but 5 loans, I think that's a lot in terms of number. I don't think that it's particularly surprising, but I think it's interesting some of the personnel who were selected to go on loan. Your thoughts on this, and what does that mean for who's left from the young guns with the first team?
Yeah, the, The loans didn't surprise me. I did feel a slight tinge of schadenfreude because Matt was out here standing, I think, last week or the week before for Sebastian Anderson, and Anderson got sent down. That's when Matt throws up his arms and is like, you know, we throw stuff against the wall. Sometimes it sticks, sometimes it doesn't. I mean, you know, Seb hasn't shown very well in the last 2 years since he, 2 years ago, had a really bad game at fullback for the Rapids. He just got absolutely torched and shortly thereafter got sent down. And then last year he didn't show at all. So I think they're still working out the kinks with his game. I actually kind of wonder with Sebastian Anderson whether there isn't some thought about whether his long-term prospects are really at fullback or whether there's a different position for him. I think fullback is a really demanding position for positioning and for reaction and for being really physically adept. I don't know if there's a better way to say that, but I feel like defense is harder than offense, that transitioning Sebastian Anderson to an attacking winger might be a better long-term move for the team. Kind of a reverse idea of how Dylan Serna, who was an attacking left midfielder, got converted to left back briefly, and it didn't take. And so they quickly brought him back to left midfield. Although at USL, he was playing again at fullback because that's where they needed him. So the interesting thing were not the players who got sent down, because Hunley and Edwards, all those were expected. For me, the players who stayed were really exciting. I thought that they would send out more players. So the aforementioned Darren Yappe is still up with the senior team. The not yet mentioned and not yet referred to Yaya Toure is still with the team, which is pretty surprising to me. And Courtney Ford is still with the team, which I think is great news for those of us who are big Courtney Ford Redemption Train fans. Like, we all want Court to come back. We want Court to play. I think, you know, we'll, God willing, the team understands what he means to the old school fans and for all of us, and that they will find a spot for him. You know, I'm fully recognizing that, like, soccer is not a sentimental sport where you play guys because it has, it makes for a good movie ending. But, like, for God's sake, my desire would be for the Colorado Rapids to bring Courtney Ford on the 70th minute of the home opener, or, you know, maybe a couple weeks even, into the season when they've got a nice big, fan attendance, you know, going. Maybe when the pandemic is kind of calmed down and the state of Colorado is allowing 50% attendance at Dick's, and you can get a decent size crowd in there for people to freaking lose their minds to see Court step onto the field. That would be a really special moment. There's one other player that I think I was, that they kept up, that I think I was surprised at, and that person is escaping my mind. Oh, Laraz Red, right? The big red show, the big red one. The Ginger Ninja himself, Ginger Ninja Redux.
Baby Ginger Ninja. He's got to usurp Jeff Larenewicz to that title, and he is yet to do that, Mark.
I think the interesting thing about Laraz is that there's huge depth in this team at midfield, you know, and there are so many options to go with. You've got Nomley and Acosta and Bassett and Price. Those are four guys for a three-man midfield, and you still keep Laraz? I mean, I think that speaks a lot about how much they like this kid. I'm really interested to see how they project him, whether they see him as a six or as an eight, or even as a 10. I don't think that's likely because they already have their 10 in Nomley, but like, it'll be really interesting to see how Laraz comes on in his first game. And where they play him. God willing, he gets some time. I think that the thing that I really think is interesting out of all this is you don't keep your young players up with the senior team if you don't think they're going to get any minutes, because that's terrible for their career, right? Like, if they don't play in any games, it's going to be detrimental to their development. So I think that speaks really highly of these guys' ability. That being said, I can slow my roll before I get going. It doesn't mean the Rapids won't loan one or two of these other guys out at the end of this week, at the end of next week, because you know, they have other places to land them. So, all right, Matt, of the guys I mentioned, you know, what surprised you? What didn't surprise you? And the guys that that got sent down, do you have any insight as to what they might do for the switchbacks? And maybe do you have any thoughts about how the switchbacks lineup comes together?
Yeah. So I think I was really surprised that Sebastian Anderson got loaned down, given that Jeremy Kelly's down there, Mark. You know, I think Jeremy Kelly also down now in the USL Championship. I guess, you know, it comes down to, you know, you've got Sam Vines on the left. We have Keegan Rosenberry on the right. And then the only other primary or natural outside back you have coming off the bench is a 33-year-old Steven Banisher. And so I have to wonder here, Mark. Mark, do you remember after Anthony Hudson tried everybody possible who naturally and talent and skill-wise fit at the right back position, just said, let me put in somebody there who's going to do what I ask them, isn't going to complain, and is going to give their 100% and absolutely not make a mistake. And can you remember who that player was in 2018 who played at right back for the final 2 months and wasn't a super great fit, but did what he asked of him and was not as much of a defensive liability as anybody else on the field? Who was that player as the unorthodox eighth right back for the Colorado Rapids in Anthony Hudson's first year?
I think it's one of our other favorite players, Marlon Hairston.
It is not Marlon Hairston. Marlon had already played there before. You remember, Mark?
Beginning of the season. Who was it?
It was Courtney Ford.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, they put Courtney Ford there, and then they decided to just have the left back overlap when they had that, and then effectively it made for a back three. So I am wondering, Mark, does Courtney Ford, as one of the five natural center backs that the Rapids now have on the roster, the six being Michael Edwards, who's now with the switchbacks, could we see a reprise of Courtney Ford occasionally playing as a reserve right back, letting Sam Vines, you know, go up and overlap? Or maybe the Rapids at times, when need to, go to a back three with Courtney Ford as the right center back is a really interesting question that I have, especially given what I would have thought about Sebastian Anderson, given Jeremy Kelly's departure. I don't know that I'm that high on Sebastian Anderson right now, Mark. You know, obviously he had the injury that derailed what was ever going to become of his season in 2020, but I just look at it and, you know, he's with the switchbacks for the majority of 2019, for the rest of 2020, albeit rehabbing. He's played in four games, Mark, in those last 2 years down in the USL Championship. So kind of, you know, we've yet to see a Rapids homegrown go to the switchbacks, get stuck in, be there for a really long time, and get regular minutes. Because when it has been, it was Sam Vines balling out, or it was Cole Bassett balling out, and then they immediately came back. And I'm not including, you know, Abdul Gwatubaye, who wasn't a homegrown here, folks. So I just kind of want to see, you know, Sebastian Anderson, you're 18 years old at this point. You're back from the knee injury that you sustained this past summer. Go win a starting job with the switchbacks. Because if he can't do that, Mark, I have some questions about what role or contributions that he's ever actually going to make to the first team. I was surprised that Michael Edwards got loaned down as well, Mark. If I just think about where he was as a, you know, regular player for the U23 team for Wolfsburg in the Regionalliga, the fourth division that you have in Germany. If he's playing well in that, Mark, you know, then I don't know that he was going to break in anytime soon for the Wolfsburg first team, but he's 20 years old. Like, you know, at some point a German, you know, a third division team is probably looking like, hey, let's bring this guy on loan as a 20, 21 year old. You know, does a second division team maybe say, you know, hey, Wolfsburg, we'll give you a menial transfer fee for effectively training this guy. And now he's a second Bundesliga player. And so I just kind of have to wonder, I have to think, Mark, being a regular starter at a U23 academy for a quality Bundesliga team, a Bundesliga team that could be in Champions League next year, and then going to USL, is that not a step down for him? And if it's not a step down, it better be because Michael Edwards is one of the anchors that they have defensively. And I think that kind of shows, Mark, where he is relative to an Austin Trusty or even a rehabbed Courtney Ford in terms of the hierarchy. Similarly, I was also surprised by Flamiaka, Mark, but maybe not so much, because maybe that just means, you know, he's not going to play that much given Cole Bassett doesn't have an Olympics to go to at this point. Cole Bassett's probably not going to be involved in the summer tournament. You know, like I now have serious questions about when is Cole's next call-up for the national team at any level, and is it prior to January camp of next year? And so in that, if Cole's not going to be gone for too long, they don't need a whole lot of depth options at the number 10-ish role in the three-man midfield Nicholas Mosqueda can be the super sub that you have for that. Yunus Nnamdi can play there if they want to have another, if they want to have somebody else as the right winger, Mark. You don't really need Philip Mayaka, and is it better long-term for him to be playing regularly in a role where it's going to be, you know, where he's still going to, he's going to be playing regularly, and it's a role where comfortably you would expect him, as, you know, people have reported, the best talent to come out of Clemson soccer ever. He should be a starter on a team that's going to, you know, whose ceiling is probably mid-table-ish in the USL Western Conference. So get him there, and then, you know, you have depth options in the midfield, given that Cole Bassett isn't going to be missing for an extended period of time. And then, you know, similarly, Mark Matt Hundley, you know, wasn't really able to stick at any point. Granted, when he was with the Switchbacks, it was with Steve Trischun. We've commented on the past how that wasn't a super amicable situation. And then similarly, his season with Memphis last year got really blown up. So I'm kind of, so to Matt Hundley and Sebastian Anderson, can you win regular minutes? Can you compete in training such that you play regularly for the Switchbacks? Philip Mayaka, Michael Edwards, go down and be the starter at, you know, central attacking midfielder and center back, respectively. And I think Abe Rodriguez, as he's shown, Mark, isn't going to start regularly for the Switchbacks, but dude's going to go out there and he's going to compete and he's going to make saves that you would not expect a 5'9" player to make. So I'm comfortable that he's in a good situation, and I'm pretty darn sure that that Chris Sharpie is going to be calling him regularly to see how things are going and making sure that he's taken care of and put in the best position for him to succeed for the short and long term of his career.
Yeah, to your point about Mayaka and Hundley, I think my biggest fear is that I would tune in Switchbacks games last year and Hundley wouldn't be playing. I mean, was that Memphis? Was he with Memphis last year? I'm trying to remember. It was 2 years ago that it was that I would tune in. It was 2019. I would tune in games. I would look forward to seeing Hundley play, and he wouldn't play. And I think I actually tuned in a couple of Memphis games and also saw that Hundley didn't play. And so I think my fear with Mayaka is, because I didn't even bring him up in this little thing, that he won't get time. I got to watch him in college. I really think a lot of Philip Mayaka. I think he's a really wonderful player with really good instincts about moving the ball. One of the things I really like about a soccer player is the complexity in soccer is, and one of the things that I've done as a coach, and one of the things you learn in some of the basic coaching training that I've done with the United Soccer Coaches in USSF, is about the aspect of soccer that's really weird is that it's one of the rare sports where you face in all 360 degrees and you have to do action in all 360 degrees, especially if you're a central midfielder, right? If you're a left or a right winger, you really are only responsible for 270 degrees of territory that you have to deal with. And realistically, it's only really like 180 degrees forward and to your right, you know, like, and maybe a little bit behind you. But, I guess it was 270 degrees is probably wrong. It was 180 degrees and 90 degrees. But a central midfielder has to really be able to see over his shoulder, move, you know, left and forward, right and backward, right? 360 degrees of the field they're responsible for. If they need to recirculate the ball back into the left, back into the right, forward, backward, wherever, left, right, they have to be responsible. One of the things that I noticed about Mayaka when he played for Clemson is that he's wonderful in every direction, right? If he needs to back the ball back out, if he needs to send it across, if he needs to send it diagonally, if he needs to dribble forward, he can do that. And he has really nice swivel vision and really good presence in the center of the field. That's a thing that he'll develop. One of the things that's different about the college game versus the pro game is just the speed at which those things develop. That Mayaka's not going to have at the USL level the same amount of time on the ball. I remember I've interviewed a few players at the USL level, and that's one of the things they comment about, that they need to learn to make that decision quicker, and that they have to unload that ball quicker. And so that's, I think, the thing that I hope we see with Mayaka, that he gets the opportunity to play in the center of the field and develop his skills and develop them quickly.
Let's close out the show here, Mark. Let's run down each of these five players and what our expectations are for them. So I guess, you know, do they not play a whole lot? Are they a bench player? Are they a regular starter? Are they an impact player for the Colorado Rapids? So let's start at the back. Abraham Rodriguez.
I feel like last year, Abrod was kind of like, you know, played about a third of the games at goalkeeper. I could look this up, but and they started the other guy over him the other two thirds of the time. I would like to see him get 50-50 this year. That's I guess, my take. Your thoughts?
I will say Abraham Rodriguez starts double-digit games for the Switchback. So it'll be at least 10. It won't be more than – he won't start the majority of games. It's 28 games this year in the USL. Right, Mark?
Oh, that's a good question. The schedule just dropped yesterday, and I didn't have a chance to look at it. So
okay, so I'll say it'll be, you know, it'll be more than 10, less than 50%. He won't be the majority starter. Michael Edwards.
Boy, that's a hard one to pick. I'm guessing he comes off the bench and has fewer than 1,000 minutes.
I think he will be the majority starter. He'll play at least 2,000 minutes for the Switchbacks at center back. Sebastian Anderson.
I'm going to take the over this time and say that he's the starting right back for the team and plays the majority of minutes and gets some development time.
I think with the schedule congestion, Mark, I don't know that the wide roles where you're going to have to do a lot of running, especially at altitude, I think those are the positions where you're going to naturally see the most rotation. I hope Seba gets at least 500 minutes. I don't know that he breaks more than like 1,200. And I would say the same thing of Matt Hundley. So there, Mark, I'll throw Matt Hundley to you.
Yeah, I'm with you on Hundley. You know, seeing him jump from not getting a lot of time on the field the last 2 years to suddenly being a starter is unrealistic, but I hope he spot starts. I think with Hundley, the challenge with him is, and this is like the kind of cliche that unfortunately I hear soccer commentators why am I having a hard time with the word soccer commentators today? I do. I'm having a problem with it. It's the kind of thing that soccer commentators overuse, which is the final product's just not there, right? Like, he's good in the buildup, but when he gets into the final third, he often has that deer in headlights look. He often also, from a wide position, will just shoot the ridiculously not smart shot, rather than look around him and see where the next available player is. So he's got to get better at that, or he's never going to move forward as a player, and he's always going to be stuck at this phase of development.
Last one, Mark, Philip Mayaka.
I think Mayaka starts. I think he gets the bulk of minutes, and I think he either shows well and is an impact player for the Switchbacks, or does the opposite in the sense that he's too good for the Switchbacks and the Rapids decide to bring him up to put him in, which, you know, for his development is not a bad thing. I see Mayaka's development in a similar way to the way I saw Shinyashiki, which is he's a really exciting player, and you should buy low on Mayaka and hold on to that stock because it'll be worth something. Not that we as pundits and fans can actually invest. If you're going to get your NFT, go get your NFT and Philip Mayaka.
I think Mark, Philip Mayaka will be one of the top three most in, for the duration that he is with the Switchbacks this year, he will be one of the top three most impactful players. I know Opta doesn't do a whole lot of stuff with USL Championship, Mark, but if I look at the end of the season, if we do goals plus for the Switchbacks on a per 90 basis, Philip Mayaka will be in the top five for Switchbacks players this year, regardless of how many games that he ends up playing.
Yeah, with Clemson, he was really good at that late run. He was a really smart final into the box kind of guy. The only challenge of that is the Rapids already have that guy, and his name is Cole Bassett. So,
all right, Mark, let's get out of here. Tell our listeners about our sponsors.
Roughneck Scarves. I feel like, Matt, one of the challenges that I've had in this show is that I've given Icarus FC a lot of love recently. We gotta give Roughneck Scarves some props. It's a wonderful product, a wonderful thing for fans as you get ready for the new season. To start thinking about scarves. If you are starting a supporters group, if you're not satisfied with the options that your supporters group may have for what your club has, you can make a custom-made scarf. My favorite of all time is perhaps of the many, many custom-made scarves from Roughneck was a few years ago. Minnesota United FC fans made a You Know Nothing Grant Wall scarf that was a total riff off of You Know Nothing Jon Snow, which I'm not a big Game of Thrones guy, but I got the reference and I found it. I understood that reference and I found it funny. So Roughneck Scarves, a great place to make custom scarves with the catchphrase from your favorite television show of your choice, Icarus FC. They make wonderful custom-made jerseys for your futsal league, for your pub league, for your youth club, or for your professional NISA level club, Icarus FC, Roughneck Scarves. Matt, tell them where you can hit us up on the socials, on the medias, on the interwebs, on the intertubes, and do not forget to oversell our Substack, which is definitely, definitely one of the best things I've ever done in the history of small niche writing.
Listeners, follow us individually on Twitter at soccer_rabbi_rabbi and at LWS Matt Pollard. Subscribe to our newsletter, which will be timely and not backed up like the Suez Canal, at holdingthehighline.substack.com. Subscribe to us via email or check us out in web form for all of the articles there. Follow us on Twitter at Rapids96podcast. Send us your questions using the hashtag AskHTHL or get to us in long form at Rapids96podcast@gmail.com. If we can bring further monetary value to your life, check out our Patreon page, patreon.com/Rapids96podcast or denverpost.com/HTHL for a really great deal on all of the digital sports content as we ramp up into MLS season and Rockies season, though I'm not sure the Rockies recaps that you'll have will be good, but if nothing else, I'm sure the Denver Post will be having some good commentary on the prospects that they have as they'll be needing them in the next couple of years. Listeners, I think at this point, Mark and I are probably going weekly at this point. We've got enough backlog of other interviews that we could do for the preseason, so we'll see you next week, folks.
Woohoo! Peace!